This is El Puente Podcast with
Kim,
Dave,
and Michael.
Conversations at the intersection of race, sexuality, religion, politics, art, music, and everything in between.
We're stronger when we build puentes to connect the POVs and POCs.
How the new social interaction is really uncomfortable, and I'm learning to grow with being comfortable with being uncomfortable about the awkwardness. Even, you know, like I was talking about on Zoom conversations, you're all of a sudden everybody's in the same room and everyone's waiting on each person to have their individual input into whatever the conversation's about. Whereas, you know, if you're at a party before COVID, you walk, you talk, you know, you roam, but it's kind of like everybody's kind of put on the spot. But the positive thing is that I am learning to just be comfortable with the discomfort, you know, and just roll with it.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting too, to see how that plays into post-quarantine, whenever that is, like how our social interactions will be altered by that. Yeah.
They're going to be altered for sure. The thing I love most about Zoom calls is how at the end of a Zoom call, everybody's always doing that awkward, bye, okay, bye, bye. And they don't really know when to end the call. They're just like for like 30 seconds.
And then you're looking for that button, to hang up and you're like, yeah.
How do I, and the last thought you always see is like, how do I turn this off?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm
good.
What about you guys, Charisse?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I have anything positive, but I'll think about it for a minute. But I have been thinking about how awkward it is, Kimberly, to your point, that you have to wait to say something. There isn't the kind of casual, polite interjection. You really have to wait until someone's done talking to start. And then you have to kind of queue up to be able to say the thing that you want to say, which can be really awkward when you need to follow up with something there. You might have three other people, then you have to wait to go back to a point that might have been four speakers back. So that is a weird, awkward thing about Zoom.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Michael Ray?
I don't know. You know, I was just thinking that surprisingly, the amount of time we've had in quarantine, outside of quarantine, just visiting with friends, catching up on things that you don't really have time to really pay attention to, and mm-hmm. even to give deep thought to how far we've come from, you know, the 60s. I was looking at John Lewis's The Last Crossing over the Pettus, George mm-hmm. Pettus Bridge. It brought a tear to my eye. Because for some reason I felt like it took me back and forward at the same time. And that was a proud moment this morning, but it was, you know, it was bringing closure to the ideas that shaped, you know, a time before I was born. And of course, you know, you get back to reality and you realize that time wasn't long ago. So despite how troubling that the issues might be, you know, just having time to reflect like that and find out, there's something magical about that for me.
Definitely, yeah, I can see that for sure. And then especially like with it happening within this context of Black Lives Matter right now. So having those two things kind of juxtaposed is, I don't know, it's almost like maybe like a passing of the torch in some way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Definitely a passing of the torch.
Mm-hmm. So I guess my positive during this time is that 25 years after I got my undergrad, I'm back in school. I'm working on my MFA right now. And I just, as of Friday. Yeah, thank you. I just finished my first semester remote learning for SAIC. And
great.
Yeah, it's a wonderful program. And in a way, it was perfectly timed because I did have nothing but being at home to devote to these studies, and so rewarding. And like, I'm so excited to start on the next the next part of it. So, yeah, so that's my positive. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Betty just finished that MFA last year, didn't she?
Yes, yes. And she's the one who's been twisting my arm. She's like, this program was made for you. You need to do this.
Oh, great. Great. And do you know Arnold Kemp?
Yes. And I got to do a studio visit with him, which was amazing.
Great. Arnold and I were in graduate school together.
Oh, excellent. He's phenomenal.
Yeah, he is. Man is.
He's magical.
Yeah.
So great.
If we were in my office on campus, I would have an Arnold Kemp behind me.
Oh, nice.
And a Michael Ray Charles.
Yes.
I want one of those.
Instead, we have one here right in front of us.
And he's got one behind him.
Yes, yes. Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and introduce you all to our listeners. So our first guest is Dr. Cherie Smith. She is a professor of art history and the chair of the Department of African and African Diaspora Studies at UT Austin. She's also the founder and executive director of the art galleries at Black Studies, the former director of the John L. Warfield Center for African and African American Studies, and the Op-Ed Project, and is the author of many articles and books, her most recent being Michael Ray Charles, A Retrospective, which surveys his career. And we also have with us the subject of said book, who is Michael Ray Charles. He is an artist whose work and research deal with how African Americans have been viewed and portrayed throughout history, particularly through racist stereotypes such as Aunt Jemima, and how that causes them to view themselves or not. His work acts as a way to speak to race in the modern world by confronting the imagery head-on to expose those stereotypes. He lectures and exhibits internationally. His work is in private and public collections from the MFA Houston to the MoMA, as well as UT Austin's public art program, Landmarks. And he was the recipient of the 2018 Rome Prize in Visual Arts. He's also, many of you may remember, featured on PBS's first season of Art 21, as well as a consultant to Spike Lee in the movie Bamboozled. So we want to welcome both of you today.
Welcome.
Thank you for being with us.
So thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're very excited.
It's an honor.
So to begin with, I want to speak with Cherie first. Would you mind kind of filling in the gaps in your biography that I just spoke to, and how it kind of speaks to or informs the work that you do academically and curatorially?
Yeah. So thanks again for having us. It's my pleasure to be here to talk with you four with Michael Ray. So I'm from Los Angeles. I grew up in Southern California. One of the I think important things to know about me, and I say this as someone who's now lived in Texas for 16 years, is that I'm a second generation Californian, but my grandparents are from Texas, or from kind of central South Texas. So I'm a reverse migrant to Texas, which is an interesting thing to think about. And, you know, I think as a Californian, I didn't think much about where my grandparents were from, partly because they didn't make it a thing. But the longer that I'm in Texas, the more that I am kind of acquainting myself with my family's Texas roots, my own Texas roots. And it's interesting to me that I have had a career that's taken me all over the country, from New York to St. Louis to Chicago and the Bay Area. And I never, ever would have thought that I would spend nearly 20 years in Texas. You know, I thought I'd be here for a couple of years and move on to some other university. So it's interesting to see all of the opportunities that Texas and Austin and UT in particular have offered to me, from making colleagues and friends like Michael Ray at UT to having a topic like this that, you know, hopefully we can talk more about this, that tries to kind of understand art making outside of the, you know, kind of main centers of production like New York and LA, in this country, that there are other places inside the country where major art making happens that get left out, and why?
Okay, and Michael, I want to do something kind of similar. If you would just speak a bit more about your background, particularly with regards to the themes in your work, maybe even speaking to something that Charisse mentioned in another podcast in discussing the book about a plastic figurine that maybe kind of formed the foundation from where your work springs.
Sure. Well, I'll start a little further back. I too lived in Los Angeles, and I think I would refer to my getting there having to do with probably the third Middle Passage, when African Americans or Black folks moved west. And then, you know, and at, having made my way back, I think in terms of the themes, I was a pretty observant kid. So there was a drastic difference between Louisiana, rural, small town Louisiana, and Compton or Watts or Englewood. And I went from being in the midst of a difference in ways I had not experienced before in LA. And then going back to Louisiana, it was a drastic shift. It was black and white. And the performances of life were no different. It was very polarizing at times. The rules were clear, where you were and who, what side you were on. So my progression sort of starts there. And then I would say, before I got to the figurines, I would have to give props to Gordon Parks. Because I ran across images of Gordon Parks early on. And I remember making a painting, sort of a father and son, which was based on one of Parks' images, which was a mother and child, reminiscent of Charles White's images of a mother in distress looking at a bill I want to reference. But I'll move forward. My earlier works were sort of an attempt to examine, I think, ideas of Blackness and Black people. And when I got into this graduate program here at University of Houston, I was in search of some idea of some sense or accuracy in terms of like how I felt Blackness was articulated in the world I had come to inherit. And after bouncing around, just really trying to deconstruct what I was doing and trying to figure out what I was doing, I decided that, you know, man could go to the moon, but we've yet to really deal with difference. I didn't realize then that it was my march to understanding otherness in relationship to these images. So that little black figurine that was casually gifted to me, I didn't think much of it until I began to use it in work and then try to get beneath the surface of what I thought blackface was. And you know, 20 plus years later, I'm still producing work that centers around not necessarily blackface, but ultimately, I think, otherness and difference, or aspects of those sort of classifiers. So the themes in my work, they've grown as I've grown, and my perspective has grown about the complexities of, you know, what's at stake in terms of Black representation, Black as a symbol, or Black, you know, African Americans here in the West, Western culture in America.
Yeah, I think that gives our listeners a great view into the work. And we're also going to share some links to both the book and images of your work as well, so that they can get a deeper view of what we're discussing here today.
Well, speaking of the book, Charisse, can you talk about the process of writing and developing the book, Michael Ray Charles, and your intended audience, and what impact you feel that that writing, this book would have on the audience and the readers?
Yeah, thanks for that question. Well, I guess it took about a year and a half for it to actually be written, but that was after years of research being conducted. And, you know, there are a couple of ways that it happened. First, I came up with an idea to write an essay on Michael Ray's work. And so I did write this essay. It was really only about 12 pages, but there were a lot of really big ideas packed into those 12 pages. And I really had a hard time kind of stopping myself in those 12 pages. And one of the big ideas that I wanted to talk about there was appropriation. So historical appropriation, thinking about past events and how Michael Ray works them out in his work, and then also appropriation of past objects. And in this first 12-page essay, I was thinking about the appropriation of Uncle Sam posters from early part of the 20th century,
right,
and a photograph of Burt Williams, who was the Caribbean-American entertainer from around the turn of the century. So I was thinking about those kinds of objects that were appropriated. And so, you know, piecemeal started to kind of put together these thoughts. Now, at the same time, at that point, Michael Ray is my colleague, and we're having regular conversations about all kinds of things, from how do you recruit students of color to who should we invite for a lecture series. I was starting to work on a project on Black and other dark works of art. So we talked a lot about that. So, you know, all of these big ideas were being exchanged between the two of us for, you know, about a decade or thereabout. And then University of Texas Press wanted, you know, kind of acknowledged that they wanted to do a book of Michael Ray's work because they're doing a series of books on Texas artists. And I proposed that I would be both the writer and the editor of that book, and they decided to give it a go. And so that's the main way that it gets going. But it's a really, really big undertaking to do an art book of the kinds that this book is. And, you know, for people who haven't seen it yet, I hope that you will go out and get it. But it's a 4-pound, you know, kind of 14 by 12 inch book that is a substantial object. And it's the kind of pretty object that you want to put on your coffee table, but make no mistake, it's not a coffee table book. And, you know, the structure of the... What did you say?
It depends on whose coffee table. It's definitely on mine.
Yes. So mine too. And our family members. but, you know, what the book does is it begins with an interview. So it begins with the artist's words about his own work. And then there's 100+ plates of works of art from the beginning of his kind of professional career until the year that the book was produced. So there's work over, you know, a 25-year period. And then there is a very substantial body of writing of mine that contextualizes the work in various histories. And so, you know, I think it's a neat project. Of course, I would say that. But what I also kind of like about it is it because it was not merely intended for an academic audience, even though UT Press published it, it's got what I think a really big prescient, you know, important ideas for what's happening right now, but written in an approachable and not for graduate students or PhDs kind of way. And so, you know, back to the writing process part of the question, I feel like, you know, because I've now been an art historian and kind of cultural thinker, curator for a long time now, and I'm more comfortable with my writing and with my voice, I wanted it to be approachable. I wanted it to be something that anyone could pick up and gain this information from. And the one thing I'd also like to say on the writing of it, and I haven't, you know, kind of put these things together, but during the writing of the book, my sister was perishing, I would say, from bone cancer. My father was just at that point diagnosed with liver cancer. And so during the writing of the book, I was going to California to do chemo with my dad. And so monthly, I'd go to California, and one of the things that we talked about while we're in the hospital together is, how's the writing of the book going? What are you thinking about now? What are you talking about now? And so the writing is also trying to connect with someone like my dad, who was a very sharp thinker, sharp mind, but not a schooled person, not a learned person, school learns person, I should say. And, you know, I wanted him to get it. And I wanted people like him to be able to get it. So, yeah, that's...
Yeah.
If we could get in...
Thank you for that.
Yeah, if we could get a little bit to Michael Ray, the work itself, because I have to tell you, just seeing your work and doing a little research about your career was, I instantly got, let me put it to you this way. Your art does exactly what really good art does. It causes people to feel something, to think something, to have a visceral, in some cases, reaction to it. And that, I have to tell you, candidly, that was exactly my reaction, visceral. And so the first question that came to mind was, I think it was in the Art 21 interview that you did a couple of years back. You said about your work that, quote, man has always tried to cover up what is most ugly about man. And you said that your art really is about race relations and American history. And you've also said that some have called you a sellout because of it, or they've questioned your blackness. And they've accused you of perpetuating stereotypes. And the one thing that I really gravitated to was you said that there's this fine line between perpetuating something and questioning something. And I guess I have my question is, do you still feel that way about your art? And if so, how does straddling that line feel for you as a Black man? Straddling that line between what you called, you know, questioning something versus perpetuating something.
I'm going to add a little humor here. I was just listening to Tony Tony earlier, so it feels good. I think that some people have more narrow paths to traverse. And I think that's what I could say about my pathway thus far. It is a narrow pathway. My intentions have never been to make folks uncomfortable with the work. I think everything that human beings create is should be called into question, and even into the context of art. And I mean, in terms of question, I think we illuminate things in certain arenas, and art, you know, is one of those things that should address the types of ugliness that we've created when it comes to constructing ideas of otherness. Now, having said that, I'm still in the business of making art, which concepts of beauty the pursuit in many, you know, cases. I mean, definitely within our systems of value, this idea of what's beautiful and its association with art. I think the work that I make is beautiful. It's all language, and I try my best to use it in ways that is harmonious and useful, I think, to the time that I live in. You know, I think the work has the ability to do a lot more than and be a lot more to folks, depending on whether they're willing or able to receive the work for what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could see how it's really going to be open to, like, again, all good art is open to the interpretation of the viewer, right? My first reaction was this visceral kind of, oh my God, you know, almost shock. And you know, I guess a lot of Black people are going to get that from seeing characters of Blackness. But there is, like you say, this beauty in your work. I mean, it's just beautiful to be, and it's striking too. So
I like, you know, the design, Will. I think of all the paintings I've done, there are very few paintings that are accurate in terms of their my intentions to accurately represent a Black person. These paintings are about white people. You know, that's not an accurate representation of a Black person. They're about ideas that white people have and have produced, have cultivated in exchange, you know, with Blacks about who and what Black people are.
Absolutely.
So part of the and also images that we as Black people and people of color have to contend with.
Exactly. And that's part of the reason I signed my paintings with pennies. It's because it's the lingering question about whether or not we're free. And in the truest sense, I think we've yet to really fully conceive what we are, people, I hate to say people of color, African-American Black folks in America. We're still wrestling with what's the proper term to identify with, you know?
Absolutely.
Look at the arc of what do you call a Black person in America since the early 20th century? I mean, we're on African-American now. So I think there's a lot more there than what meets the eye.
Absolutely. And speaking of that, I know that we have discussed being Black and Blackness, and I'd like, you know, to hear from both of you, but Charisse, can you talk to our viewers or our listeners, excuse me, about Blackness and what that means to you? Explain what it is, in your opinion, and if you feel like it's like an existentialist process?
Wow, that's, you know, that's the $1 million question. that's a big one. You know, I think that Blackness is a whole host of things. It is separate from a Black identity or separate from an African-American identity. In some ways, it is an idea of what those things are, what identities are, but it's also representations that we both make and that we consume and sometimes deploy and circulate ourselves. And so I think it's a kind of fluid, amorphous thing that we sometimes tap into. Sometimes we're a part of and sometimes we're not a part of. It's a very complicated thing, this idea of Blackness. And I do feel like it is both an existentialist thing, meaning that it has to do with our mindset, what we think we can do in the world, what we are able to do in the world. But it's also an ontological thing, how we're able to be in the world. What our kind of you know, not just psychological and not just spiritual, but a more holistic thinking about who and what we are. And I think on the one hand, one might be able to divorce one's ethno-racial identity from those thoughts, but I think in some ways you can't separate ethno-racial identity out from it. It's a good and hard question that you just asked.
No, I know. It's just kind of like when people ask me, you know, what is Black music? You know, it's a very loaded question, but yeah. It's nice to hear. Like, I like to give my specific, you know, take on how that affects being Black. To me, you bring your Black experience into the music. So that is what makes it Black music, is your experience. So it is both. You know, I loved your answer, you know, because it encompasses all of those.
It does. Yes.
And I would say, I mean, of course, I'm not Black, but it's almost like something that exists outside of or your daily lived experiences. All people, you know, Black, Latinx, even LGBTQAI+ people, we find that we have to edit ourselves or be different and depending on the social circumstances. Would you say that Blackness is something that exists outside of that, like whether you're code-switching for this group of people or that?
If you think about language is produced and it's shared, it is exchanged. Being Black is one part of the characteristic, the overall characteristic. You know, there are other dimensions and aspects of things that of me as a person that, given the context, flourish in ways that I could cling to it in ways that I don't need to emphasize Blackness, for example. And in certain environments, definitely, you know, I could draw upon Blackness as a different source and illuminate it in a different way. So I think of it as being a part of who I am. I don't mean to imply that it's how everybody else thinks of me. You know, I could dress myself up however I choose, but it's until the other are able to deal with the symbols that I've assembled and are transmuting and can trust those things in the way that I trusted that the truest sense of who I believe I am, they get. So I think it's a part of language, like everything we produce as humans.
Love that.
You know, one of the things that I wrote this article, I guess, about a month ago on Juneteenth, among other, and digital blackface, among other things, and hyperallergic. And I was talking about how we're kind of constantly becoming and or participating in Blackness, and we're getting steeped in it the longer that we're on this planet and engaging with our culture. Our different cultures, I should say. And one really positive and just, you know, really warm feeling I had was watching Hip Hop Evolution, the most recent season. I don't know if any of you are have watched that on Netflix.
No.
But one recent episode from season 4, I brought it to Michael Ray's attention. It's about bounce music, and the opening couple of minutes are kind of documentary footage of New Orleans from the 70s, for the late 60s and early 70s, and you see people just having house parties and lawn parties and barbecues. It took me back to the 70s of being a kid and being in those kinds of parties where, you know, the adults were dancing and having their beers and the kids were running around doing their thing. And I just had this feeling like, I love Black people. I love what we create. I love what we do. I love the energy that we bring to things. I love how we move our bodies. And that's Blackness. That is one piece of it. That's not all of it. But it was a really warm and fuzzy, I love my people
kind of moment. Oh, that's beautiful.
That I had. So I highly recommend watching that episode of... Now, there are problems.
I'm all about it.
Yeah. There's problems too.
Yes.
Bounce music, but you know, I love bounce music, but
yes. Well, and there's even a problem here because they do very straight kind of, I mean, they do admit to women making bounce music, but they don't go far enough. different and sexualized.
That's New Orleans, baby. You heard me?
Yes.
I love it.
Well taking the... Go ahead, Michael. Go ahead.
No, I'm just going to just comment on that. Like, I mean, even just the pervasiveness of, like, bounce culture. A Spanish artist that Dave and I really love, Mala Rodriguez. She's a Spanish hip-hop and rap artist. And a Big Frida is on one of her songs, and just, like, it's so great to, like, see that connection, you know. Yeah.
And we've talked about this on the show before, how hip-hop is and Black music really has transcended the world. I mean, you've got artists collaborating in Spain, and you've got rappers in Mexico now rapping in Mayan. I mean, it's all over the world.
Korea.
Korea. And that's another example of how our Blackness has been shared and talked about and exploited throughout the world, all of those things, you know. Shifting the conversation a little bit to kind of like the cultural moment that we're in right now, I think you guys are wonderful to talk to about what we're really experiencing right now, given what you guys really delve into in your work. Me and Michael were wondering about, you know, some of the changes we've seen recently in terms of advertising, in terms of the conversation around Confederate monuments being taken down, you know, Quaker Oats retiring the Aunt Jemima image. Michael Ray, I wondered specifically, considering what you delve into with your work, the reassessment of these stereotypes in media, in commercial art, advertising, and then larger, the conversation, this move to almost kind of erase all of, I don't want to say erase, that maybe that's the wrong word, but to take down from public space images that are offensive to us.
You know, this morning, again, I was watching John Lewis's body crossing the George Pettus Bridge, and there was talk about wanting to rename the bridge John Lewis. It was mentioned that Lewis himself didn't want the bridge to be named after him because he wanted the presence of that name to be forever there, and he didn't want people to forget. I, digging through stuff that, you know, cultural stuff that so many of us have for many years thought was not relevant, you know, it was everywhere around us. You know, I think of the different ways in which certain ideas about, you know, the presence of the Confederacy was presented to me as a kid. I mean, I'm watching cartoons, and we classify them as racist cartoons, but we're watching Bugs Bunny saying, you know, Dixie, and they're recreating vehicles for inquiry into the Civil War, its meanings, in playful ways, and through various forms of in our society. The presence of the past has always been there. I think it's absurd to really, you know, not use this as an opportunity to learn from the presence of the past. And what I mean by that, let's figure out how in the hell did Confederate statues end up in areas where there was never a battle? Why are they in North Dakota and South Dakota? What is the system that's in place that allows for statues to be created and then placed? And let's map these things. Let's understand how and why. It's a part of our evolution as a culture, as a whole. Because if we remove it, like, to my disappointment, seeing the vandalism and the removal, God, there's nothing there. But that doesn't mean the thing that we want to remove is gone. It's always present because it's closer to us than what we think.
Wow.
You know, I think recontextualizing where and how we interact with, you know, such sculptures or statues is one thing. place them in a context. We are supposed to be evolving people. Not cancel, and destroy the past. And I think it'll be detrimental moving forward when we're reminded that just because that was removed, we didn't use it as an opportunity to gain from understanding how it got there in the first place.
I mean, let me code switch here, but on the Aunt Jemima topic, I feel like they should have been done that.
You see what I mean? That's a perfect example. In fact, I did a painting, slight new change for twice as much fun. The removal or the shift from the first or earlier origins of the Aunt Jemima image to which was the current image. And the same thing. We changed it. We've softened it. We've made it more tolerant. But then we go on consuming it. And then we don't think about what it actually, what it actually is. It's still the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's paramount to treating symptoms, but ignoring the disease as it continues to ravage.
Phasing out that product, the language is important. Uncle Tom, Aunt Jemima, right? The language is very, very important in this. Phasing out that product, I don't know, they may be phasing out the entire thing. I'm sure there were a lot of smart people in the room. They thought about, well, would you just change the image? Just change the image again? I'm all for how we deal with the presence of the past and righting the wrongs. However, I just feel like, okay, this is there's a lot of folks out there that feel like this is one for Team Black. It was like, we win.
Yeah. It's performative. It's performative more than anything. Yeah.
Well, it would be nice if they had an explanation. This used to be up, because of this, and explain the context, the historical context of when it was brought up, maybe add versus destroy. I don't know. That's my opinion.
It's very in line, Michael Ray, with your belief that, part of what you do with your art is to examine the history and just kind of warts and all, if I could paraphrase like that, just not shine away from it, but really taking a hard look at the ugly parts too. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. What's interesting, I think one of the biggest challenges, for Black person as an artist today is the lingering question of how do you get out of this box that we're in and in which we produce again. And I don't think that we can ever truly evaluate or construct images and ideas about a different kind of Blackness that is independent of whiteness. And I think both are constructed and reinforced within this cultural context, within Western culture. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges moving forward. We could appropriate images from various African cultures and not really have a true context in how we use them in some cases. But I think the overarching challenge is how do we create images that truly reflect who we are, avoid of someone initially designating what Blackness is and what Blackness isn't as it pertained to their hierarchical position. And in Western culture, I think that's, how it started. I think defining Blackness was done by Greeks and Greco-Romans. So we're still dealing with that.
I feel like it is a really complicated thing. I mean, we're talking about marketing here. We're talking about a language of racial hierarchy, to Michael's point. And then we're talking about the objects themselves and what do we do with them? The sculptures, the statues, the other kinds of memorials that have been made. I feel like the marketing component, they're going to do whatever they can to sell something. So, without not necessarily ethically, but in a way that's expedient for getting stuff sold. So there's that thing. The racial hierarchy part, it is a complicated language that doesn't just apply to Black people. In fact, Michael Ray has, in various parts of his work, tried to kind of figure out, what does the old Taco Bell language that has the, and this is back in the 70s when there was a figure with a big sombrero that's, mm-hmm. leaped up against a big cactus, a saguaro cactus, yeah. Kind of hanging out in the sun. Yeah. And so, there are these visual and then visual stereotypes and narratives that go with them, that even if we get rid of Aunt Jemima and Uncle Tom and the big sombrero Mexican figure leaning against the cactus, all of that stuff still lives. And so part of the problem is that there are these symbols that are now fairly easy to get rid of and take away, but we haven't begun to really touch the troubling and the troubling narratives that really oppress us all in relation to white people that go along with those symbols. Then there's still the commemorative part, which I can talk more about, but I'll...
Yeah, that's the next podcast, guys, when we come back.
Right.
one of the ways, guys, that I think, Charisse, that, you know, if you hit on it, it lives on even if you take these things away, is through exercisings of blackface in various forms. And I know Kim was really interested to know a little bit more about the concept. Kim, you had a question about digital blackface that you
want? We're going to leave the conversation at that point for now and come back to it at a later date. So keep your eyes peeled and your ears ready for part two of our conversation with Dr. Charisse Smith and artist Michael Ray Charles. Stay tuned.
Thanks again for listening to El Puente Podcast, an intersectional conversation where all our voices can meet.
Don't just sit there, stand up. Don't just listen, join the conversation.
On Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Patreon. Or email us at bocamadremedia@gmail.com.